Hi everyone, and welcome back to Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Thea. Today, I'm joined by Lowell Shepherd to talk about his book, Dare to Dream, Develop the Courage and Tools to Realize High-Stake Dreams. In this first part of our discussion, we hear about Lowell's background and his many adventures, including his training to sail the Pacific Ocean, and by the time he's 17. Lowell is a seasoned adventurer, author, YouTuber, and most recently the host for a new TV series on History Channel called Dare to Dream. He's also the founder of the Never Too Late Academy, which seeks to help people everywhere acquire the courage and tools to realize high-stake dreams. He currently lives in Japan on his boat. Based on Lowell's own experience, Dare to Dream provides important insights on how to redesign your life, awaken dormant dreams, create audacious goals, and take high-stake risks to achieve them. Hello, it's great to have you with us on a Lit Radio podcast. I'm very excited to speak with you about your new book, Dare to Dream. And my first question is, why did you decide to write it?
I decided to write Dare to Dream as a follow-up to a previous book called Never Too Late, 10 Tips to Change the Course of Your Life. And because I was embarking on a new challenge called Pacific Solo, I went back to that book called Never Too Late, 10 Tips to Change the Course of Your Life for my own inspiration. That particular book was published in 1988. I went into four languages, Russian, Portuguese, French, and English, of course. And I kind of forgotten about it until I was kind of feeling nervous about my own upcoming challenge. So I reread my own book and it kind of became my manual. And I started a YouTube channel, started preparing for the crossing of the Pacific Ocean. I bought a boat and more people were beginning to call themselves Never Too Laters and following me. And I was encouraged to write a follow-up book. And so that's part of the answer. And the second answer is, after I announced my plans to cross the Pacific solo in a sailboat before I was 70, and I announced that when I was 64 years old, I'm now 68 years old, the History Channel approached me and they asked if they could film me going across the Pacific. I said, "Do you mean come on the boat with me? It's supposed to be solo." They said, no, we'll put cameras on the boat and we want to do a 60-minute documentary because you're an old guy doing something you've never done before. And we'd like to make it a reality TV program." And I said, "Okay, that's fine, but I'm not going for a few years. Like I have to learn how to sail. I even have to, at that point, buy a boat." And they said, "Oh, okay, well, just tell us when you're going." So we left it at that. Then I got a boat and decided I need to train for 3 or 4 years. And several months went by. I was sailing around Japan. And then History Channel approached me again, said, "Well, listen, we won't do the 60-minute documentary for until you do it, but we also think you'll make a great travel show and with the title Dare to Dream." And to basically, the show would be a travel show of sorts, but an old guy, that's me, new hobby, that's sailing, discovering remote Japan. And they wanted to meet me at certain places I went to. So they came up with the initial name, Dare to Dream. And then I was encouraged, well, let's just make this the follow-up book from Never Too Late, a companion book to the TV series. But I couldn't write it right away because I just took notes and I was talking to other people, perhaps collaborating with me. And then Paul Dupuy, who's a fellow author with Lid Publishing, introduced me to Martin. Martin Liu. Liu, is that how you say his name? Liu? Yeah. And it was agreed that Lid would be the publisher. And then that brought real focus. So this is my ninth book that I've written. And so I'm accustomed to publishing processes. So we signed a contract. And so it was those two influences. The follow-on from a previous book and also a companion book to the TV series.
Well, that's a very interesting story, definitely. And
and tell you, I should add at this point, I flew into Nagoya yesterday from where my boat is in southern Japan, because I'm speaking at the Japan Writers Conference this weekend about the new book, Dare to Dream, and about the TV series. So I flew in. I was having dinner with my wife last night, and we were just kind of channel surfing, looking for something to watch. And I went to Nat Geo, Discovery, Animal Planet, and then History. And they were showing, because we filmed the pilot, which they have now showed repeatedly. And then suddenly last night I saw the pilot again on TV. It was kind of weird, and my wife was giggling all the way through.
Well, yeah, that's great. It's great to see yourself on TV. I bet. Yeah. Well, and you mentioned your previous book, Never Too Late, and you're also running an academy with the same name. So could you tell us a bit more about that and what you're doing for people at the academy?
Well, again, there were two triggers for the Never Too Late Academy. One is, I've come from the nonprofit sector, so I didn't sell a company to afford this dream. I didn't have a mountain of money. I had a fairly modest pension, which I've sunk in completely. So I couldn't treat my vision of Pacific Solo as a hobby. I had to make it a business. And so the small channel is that, and I have various other things going on, sponsors to generate income, et cetera, et cetera. So the Never Too Late Academy grew out of a need to make money. And so I started a business with investors. But also what prompted this particular business was the people that started to follow me. And they called themselves Never Too Laters. And at first it was older men like me. And then more and more became more diverse. And even young couples were signing up, coaching them, et cetera, on how to realize a dream, how to navigate fear, how to, you know, our mission statement is helping people everywhere acquire the courage and the tools to realize audacious dreams. So the Academy has online courses and resources where, number one, we try to inspire people to dream big, but also give them tools how to actually make that dream come true. So it was those two reasons. I needed to keep working from the boat, and I've become a digital nomad. I talk about this in the book, but also it was in response to a real need, to helping people like me. So we have a growing Never Too Late community, and that's why we called it the Never Too Late Academy.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you for sharing. But now let's dig a little bit deeper into the new book, Dare to Dream. So it's separated in a few parts, and the first one covers your memoirs of a misfit dreamer, yeah, as you call it. So let's start with your childhood. So could you tell us what was it like? What role did it play in shaping the person you are today, as you said, a never too later?
Well, our childhoods all influence who we are as adults. It's not the only influence, because we can change ourselves, as I did to some measure. But I was a middle child, and when I was born, the doctors thought that I was, in those days, this was back in the 50s, the term they used was mentally retarded. Now, that's a fairly nasty phrase that's no longer in our modern lexicon, thankfully. But that's what the doctor said to my parents. And the reason being is I didn't speak any words until I was 3 years old. All I said was ish. And the family tale is that only my sister understood what I meant. And it was the day that she started school, she's older than me, that I said my first word. And it was pop. In Britain, I think we call it soda pop, fizzy drinks. In Canada, we just call it pop. And I was thirsty. I wanted a pop at the grocery store. But there was this, there, I felt different from the very from a very early age. When I was 3 years old, I fell out of a car. I had a concussion, stitches. That was a fairly traumatic experience. And then when I started school, I still remember a white wooden school in the town of White Rock. I was now 5 years old, and I was diagnosed with a learning disability. And I don't know what they called it in the school, but I know that I was in a classroom by myself. And so I felt different from the beginning. And then my father, who was a minister, and he moved from parish to parish every couple of years, I moved to new schools, and eventually they kind of lost the records. Nothing was computerized back then, but I just felt different. And it meant I was very quiet and awkward. And it was, you know, in hindsight, my brain was fine. And I had this kind of a split opinion of myself, that on one hand, I saw myself as stupid, because I couldn't articulate, even to this day, and in hindsight, it's mild autism that I had and have. And so even to this day with speech, the longer the syllable, the slower I have to say it, because I have to visualize each syllable. So as I say the word syllable, I have to visualize syllable. And I still have a speech impediment to this day. So I thought I was stupid. On the other hand, there's part of me thinking, like, why I would come to a conclusion or solve a problem much quicker mentally than most people around me. And by no means am I saying I'm a genius, but there's part of me thinking, you know, I think quickly, I can process incoming data and come to the right conclusion, or at least make a judgment if an opinion is necessary. So those are my early primary years. And I just began to develop coping mechanisms, adapting. And then has kind of got into my teen years. You know, I was very nervous around girls, with even my own name. If I was asked what my name was, my name is kind of difficult to this day. I'd get stressed. Lowell Shepherd. Shepherd, I can say, but Lowell. I still have trouble saying it. So those early years, that's why I was a misfit. But I was a dreamer. And early on, I dreamed about doing things. And it related to travel and endurance sports, crossing deserts, flying airplanes, and sailing boats. And at the age of 10, I had an epiphany of sorts that was emotional. It was an actual dream in the middle of the night that was spiritual in texture. I'm not trying to suggest it was from God or divine or in any way, but, you know, in the whole mixture of my life coming together, this mixture of feeling like a misfit, yet I was dreaming, I kind of woke up in tears, almost frightened by this vision of the future, of me as somebody who would leave a legacy and do things. And so that was my childhood.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that very personal story. It seems like you had a bit of a difficult beginning, but yeah, see where you are now. And talking about that dream, I think in the book you say you found your superpower back then because of that dream. So what is the superpower?
Well, I think in the end, we all have more superpowers than what we think. But for me, the word I would use now is tenacity. And I talk about the importance of perseverance in the book, about endurance, and the ability to endure discomfort to realize an ambitious goal is a superpower, where your eyes see something on the horizon that, although there are struggles and obstacles along the way, and on my current challenge, there are many, and they are still current, some of them, and your route may change, your tactics may change, but you've got your eyes on that goal. And so the ability to persevere is, I would say, a superpower that I it's a muscle that I developed, and it's a super muscle. And in some ways, I think it's the muscle that, rather than our kind of physiological muscles that degrade with age, the perseverance muscle strengthens with age. I think you get more and more tough as you get older. So tenacity, endurance, perseverance. In Japan, there's a word called gambatte. It basically means please persevere. So when you climb Mount Fuji, which tens of thousands of pilgrims do every year, and it's like a six-hour step machine, as you're going up, there's thousands of pilgrims coming down. And the ones coming down say to the ones going up, gambatte kudasai, which means please persevere. And it's said with a sense that keep going, because this is not a literal translation, but it's more what is connoted by the saying. It's like, if you succeed, we all succeed. So it's that gambaru spirit that Japan has only helped fuel within me, that see the summit, keep going. Yeah, if you need to stop and rest, if you need to go to a lower level to get more oxygen, to recover, all that's fine. But gambatte kudasai, keep going, keep going. Don't give up, never give up. It's never too late to try. Keep trying.
Oh, that's a great superpower to have. And then let's talk a little bit about your many adventures. And one of the most remarkable ones is include a very long bike rides. So you actually wrote a book about one of them called Chasing the Cherry Blossom. So how did you get so passionate about bike riding? And could you share some of the adventures that you had?
Sure. I moved to Japan with my wife. She was born and raised here, and I'm a Canadian. But the deal was, when we first married, if she went with me to England, where I wanted to live, one day I'd follow her to Japan. So we moved to England, and that's where our boys were born. And I worked hard, and my career in the nonprofit sector, flourished, I would say, in terms of the opportunities I was given. But I was working long hours. My health suffered. And so when we moved to Japan, it was an opportunity to recalibrate my life. And I was writing books then and doing some postgraduate work. And I had some grants to live off of. And I had done endurance sports as a teenager, a cross-country runner. And my very first endurance feat was when I was 12 and walked 35 miles, 50 kilometers approximately, raising money for a charity working in Haiti. And that always stuck with me, because I realized I really enjoyed that challenge when I was 12 years old. And I write about that challenge in the book and some key moments in it. And so I'll just encourage anybody who's listening, buy the book and find out about a moment that happened at mile 31 that revived me. Something really critical happened, and it involved somebody else. But that stuck with me. But then all those years building my career, less and less physical, I became unhealthy. I was sick. So when I came to Japan, I could recalibrate my life. Plus, trying to be economical with I had a grant, but no constant income coming in. We wanted to just live as minimally as possible. And my wife suggested, why don't you get a bike rather than a car? And a good idea. And so we went shopping, and I knew how to cycle, but I've never cycled more than like 10 minutes. And so we went to this high-end mountain bike store. And then my wife says, hey, you're a writer. You should offer to give this guy a year's worth of English classes in trade for a bike. So it was about a 1,200-pound bike. And we agreed a year's worth of English lessons. I didn't come here as an English teacher here, because I'm in Japan now. But he agreed. And, as a side, I think I was the highest paid English teacher in Japan that year because he only came four times. So I got £300 a lesson for teaching, which was pretty good. But more importantly, it was a good bike. And when I got on that bicycle, the first 100 meters, I fell in love with cycling. With bicycles, you get what you pay for. So the more expensive the bike is, probably it means the better the components. So I started riding my bike and I started doing cross-country cycling, loving it. And then at that time, I just finished a dissertation about changes in youth culture in Japan for my master's degree out of Sheffield University. And it was there I thought, I'd love to ride my bicycle from Kyushu to Hokkaido, about 3,000 kilometers, during the cherry blossom season, because it's a perfect speed to stay in the cherry blossom viewing season. Because in Japan, something remarkable happens every March, April. For the 5 or 6 days that cherry trees blossom in a community, people come out of their offices and classrooms and homes, and they party underneath the cherry blossoms. And there's lanterns up and they drink sake and eat sushi and everything's very animated. It's a great time to talk to the Japanese, but only lasts a handful of days because it's so fleeting. And that's what they're celebrating, is how fleeting life is. So enjoy the moment. That's the whole kind of philosophy and mindset behind it. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to stay in that cherry blossom window for 6 weeks as that cherry blossom front moved up the archipelago of Japan? And so I thought, well, I can't really afford to do this. So I wrote my then publisher, a Lion out of Oxford, and pitched this at my editor, then Morris Lion, Lion spelled a different way. And they agreed and commissioned me to write a travel book in the deep genre. That's what got me into cycling. It was fantastic for 6 weeks. And I had struggles. At one point, I almost gave up because of tendonitis in both knees. I found out that tunnels, which I used to avoid, became great places to scream out of pain and kind of anger. Like, my knees are hurting. But I made it, and what a feeling of accomplishment. Since then, I've done a lot of Japan coast to coast. I've cycled around I've circumnavigated the biggest island, which is 5,000 kilometers. And I did that in three phases over 3 years with my dog, with her in a trailer behind me. And there's 47 prefectures in Japan, and I've been to over 30 of them by bicycle. So bicycling changed my life. It saved my life. Then I entered triathlons and cycling races, and I've led cycle trips across Cambodia, raising money for our charity there, to Tiger Country and to Bandit Country. Going back to when I was 12 years old, where my adventure also raised money to help others, I've been a great believer in adventures with purpose, that any challenge we take on, particularly of a physical nature, where it can appear we're kind of being selfish and self-indulgent, we can leverage that adventure to help others as well.
Absolutely. And the Japanese celebrations about the last days of the cherry blossom flourishing really sounds great. And yeah, it seems you also had a fantastic trip. Yeah, there were difficulties, but
could I just add something that the listeners may be interested in? Is that April is also the month when everything starts afresh in Japan. So that's the start of the new school year. March is the end of the school year. April is the month when there's the new intake into companies of university graduates. So April is always the month of beginnings. In our culture, spring is also new beginnings. But in Japan, it's really embedded in the fabric of society and the way the systems work. So that's why the celebration is very meaningful. Like, new beginnings. Let's seize the moment. But in May, they have what they call, in English, May sickness. And May sickness is the depression that can begin to set in out of disappointment that your hopes are not being realized, that the new job isn't what you expected it to be, that the new beginning, new grade, you're struggling with at school. And so in my book, I deal with that as well. How do you, it goes back to tenacity, how do you keep going? We can start, we can come to the starting blocks with gusto, but get halfway around the track or even in the first, the beginning of it, and quickly exhaustion sets in.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting, really, to hear. Yeah, knowing other cultures better, because we don't have such a thing here in the UK, and probably in the rest of Western Europe. So yeah, thanks again for sharing. And then your new passion is boat sailing. And as you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, you've set yourself a very ambitious goal, which is to cross the Pacific Ocean. So, and by the time you're 70. So could you tell us how did this goal form and how is your training going at the moment?
Yes, quite happy to update, answer both aspects of the sailing. The dream of crossing an ocean by sailboat has been with me since early adolescence. And I just had this romantic notion of I'd like to do that someday. And at that point, I wasn't sailing. But then in my early teen years, I sailed dinghies on Deer Lake in Vancouver, Canada. Well, this is kind of cool. You know, that there's that feeling when that puff of wind comes and fills your little sail. And I mean, Deer Lake is just a pond. And then I did more of that. And then my friend Doug Hoffman, I say this in the book, an air traffic controller in Canada, because I was also studying to be a pilot at a time. That was a big dream. And he bought a 26-foot sailboat. And I went out with him, learned a few tricks sailing. And then it's probably quite, you know, reckless on his part. He said, go ahead and take it out when you want. So I did. And I'd spend weekends on it and take my wife out on it before she was my wife. We had dated and courted that way. And then it stopped sailing because we moved on to England. And although a couple of summers we'd go to Greece and one, I would spend a week on a sailboat with somebody else as a skipper and sail lasers. And then we got to Japan. Laser is a very fast type of dinghy. And we used to go to the lake in our early years here, where my wife used to holiday as a child. And there they had a laser. So I'd sail lasers there. But when I came to Japan, I'd given up my dream of ever sailing across an ocean because it just seemed too impossible out there, too expensive. Now I'm in a country where I can hardly speak the language and there's a lot of regulations. But then I discovered the Tokyo Sail and Power Squadron, an English sailing club that allowed people like me to get their license in English, write the exam in English and take the course in English. So I did that and then just began to crew in other boats. And then as I crewed in other boats and I realized this isn't as arcane or out of reach as I thought. It's possible. Boats aren't that expensive. And so like sometimes it's happened to me, an idea comes, it's formed fairly quickly. And so suddenly this idea formed a Pacific Solo of saying, you know, I can do this. And it kind of was this train thought, I'm gonna buy a boat. I'm gonna move on that boat. And you know what? And I'm talking to myself, I'm gonna sail that boat to Canada to see my mom and put a smile on her face. And then the last thing I said, and I'm gonna do it by myself. So this was such an outlandish, and it's typical of some other challenges I've done. One time I walked 100K in one day, a New Year's Day, wanted to start out the year, and I only decided 3 days before to do it because I'd already walked 50 kilometers one day for my 50th birthday, raising money for Hope. And this was a couple years later. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go for a walk on New Year's Day. And then I thought, I need to at least walk 50K and match what I did. And then just like that, I thought, I'll double it. I'll walk 100K, which I did. So, and I'm using that as an illustration to make this point. With that particular audacious and rather silly goal, I blurted it out because I knew I would do it. And I let my family know right away. They knew I would do it, and they just let me do it. But with this time, where I had this stream of consciousness and these ideas come in, I can buy a boat. I'm going to move on it. I'm going to sail across an ocean by myself to see my mom. That seemed so scary that I didn't share it with anybody. And so some dreams, and I give this advice in the book, some dreams that we have are robust and durable. We can blurt them out. We know, and everybody around us knows, yeah, Taya's going to do that. Yeah, we know enough about her. Yeah, she's got the inner tenacity to do that. It's robust. It's strong. But other ideas that we come up with are fragile. And so such was the case with this one of the sailing. I had to then question myself, really? Like, why do you want to do this? Will you do it? And so I went through, it was at least days and maybe weeks where I had to answer a lot of questions to myself. And then in the concentric circles of my relationships, I began to share it. Now believing, yes, I do want to do this, but still testing it out. So wife first, sons next, grandson, daughters-in-law, my brother, sister, my mother, close friends, and the circles are getting wider and wider. And each time and some of them were scared by it, but none of them said, don't do it. One colleague said to me, I named the project Pacific Solo. And one colleague said to me, she wrote back and she said, Pacific Solo, that she kind of expected that's what I would do. So on my 64th birthday, I was crewing on other boats, but I made three announcements. And I announced 2 months before my birthday party, at my party, I was going to make three announcements. So I kind of lured people to come, and you know, even my own sons were wondering what I was going to announce. I let them know finally beforehand, but they were thinking, Dad, like, what are you going to announce? And the three announcements was, number one, time for somebody else to take over the running of the NGO that I founded with others, Hope International Development Agency. I'd grown it as much as I could. I need to stay involved, but now step aside, let somebody else take the leadership. Secondly, I wanted to return to speaking and writing and reflecting on things and leave a written legacy and it turns out a visual legacy for my grandson and his generation. And so I was going to start a consultancy called Navigate 22. This was in 2019, by the way. And then thirdly, I announced there was about 60 people gathered. They had all paid $50 to come to this barbecue. So that's all we could have. We sold it out. But thirdly, I announced, and I'm going to buy a boat. I'm going to sail across the Pacific Ocean. And now I had refined it. I'm going to sail to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch to witness it. And I'm going to sail into English Bay in Vancouver, Canada, with my mother to greet me and put a smile on her face. And everybody goes, whoa. And I talk about in the book the importance about the announcement. And the book is about audacious dreams, ambitious ones, high-stake dreams. And one way to solidify your resolve is go public, make an announcement. That then forms a degree of accountability and a degree of shame and embarrassment. You know, that helps keep you going. That helps keep you tenacious. All those complications. So that was in 2019. Everything happened. I thought all that would happen in 2020 in terms of finding my successor, starting the business, and buying a boat. But in fact, I found a successor within 3 months. I mean, I went through process with the board, interviews, and I found a boat within 3 months. And within 4 months, it moved on border in Tokyo Bay. And then 2020 was no year to start the consultancy with speaking. So I made a little bit of money that year through some consultancy, but I could devote myself full time. So I lived on the boat since end of June 2019. And the aim was to cross the Pacific before I'm 70. But because everything was speeding up and I had more time to devote to sailing, and because my mother was aging and suffering from Alzheimer's, I made an attempt. I tried to prepare to leave when I was 66 in 2021. And so I that gave me real focus to upgrade the boat, make the investment in sales and electronic gear. I had to get sponsors, so it brought real focus. And the plan was to sail for a week solo from Tokyo to Okinawa as a stress test for me in the boat to see if the boat and I were ready. And I wanted to be 80% ready by March 2021, sail to Okinawa, then come back a month later to finish the 20% of getting ready, and then cross the Pacific May and June time, which is the prescribed 2 months to cross that direction because of typhoons and different things. The stress test worked because I got about a third of the way to Okinawa, and I realized the boat and I were not ready. So after the couple of days, I diverted to Miyaken, a prefecture, and I was exhausted. I was 27 hours without sleep, going through two storms, 4 meter waves. The auto helm wasn't working. That was one of the problems with the boat. And I had to reconsider then what I was doing and my timeline. And so I talked to all my sponsors, all my advisors, and said, you know, I'm not ready. The boat's not ready. So I need to go back to trying to do this before I'm 70. Without exception, everyone was relieved because they all knew it. But they knew I had to discover that for myself. So since then, I've been sailing around Japan, and History Channel approached me. And the very up-to-minute thing is that my boat, which I love, her name is Wahine. She's my home. She's my laboratory. She's my studio. She's my creative space. There's legal complications with her, taking her out of the Japanese waters. And so I'm now reconsidering whether she's the boat I'm going to use. And also, subsequently, my mother has passed away. So going to Vancouver is no longer that emotional draw, but that childhood dream of crossing an ocean is still real to me. I've also been advised to question, I still may do it solo. And one idea at the moment is go to California, buy or borrow a boat there, sail the opposite direction back to Japan, and which is the easier way because then you're going with prevailing winds. If you look at sailors who sailed from Japan to the west coast of America, you see in the North Pacific, their tracks are all like this, zigzags, looping back, because they're avoiding low pressure areas and there's no prevailing winds. But if you look at the track of sailors coming from the west coast of America to Japan, straight line, basically with the following wind the whole way. So I'm at the very moment kind of considering options I have, and nothing I can declare at the moment in this podcast. But what I've come to realize is I love living on the water. I love living on a boat in confined space. And my life has been changed and enriched. And I was told that with sailing, particularly solo, your highs will be higher, your lows will be lower. That has proven to be the case. I've had some very low moments, but the high moments make up for them.
Well,
I talk a lot.
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. Well, and first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your mom, but I'm looking forward to seeing how this unfolds in the end, because I'm sure it's going to be a very interesting journey. Thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and at Lit Business Media on LinkedIn for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. We are now also on TikTok, so make sure you follow us at Lit Publishing. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.